Play and stay on Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. Stand up paddleboarding, hiking, great restaurants and breweries. I'll tell you more about your next vacation destination later in the show.
Cairo, Seattle.
Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, Kenji Lopez Ault. Kenji is a best-selling cookbook author, food writer for Serious Eats and the New York Times, and more than a million people are subscribed to his YouTube channel, where he cooks with a GoPro camera strapped to his forehead. Kenji won a James Beard Award for his first cookbook, The Food Lab, has a best-selling children's book called Every Night is Pizza Night, and his brand new cookbook is called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. A prominent ingredient in Kenji's last meal is Szechuan peppercorn. Peppercorn, neither pepper nor corn. Discuss. Which is exactly what we're going to do, because botanically, Szechuan peppercorn is not a peppercorn, nor is it a chili. So I consult with Dr. Stuart Faramond, food science specialist and author of Science of Spice. We talk about what a Szechuan peppercorn actually is and why it numbs your mouth when you eat them. But first, my conversation with Kenji Lopez Ault. I am curious how you came to food in the first place, because you went to school for architecture. So how did you shift over into this career?
I mean, it was all accidental. I actually started school as a biology major, and I'd spent some time working, you know, summers in biology labs. And then I realized that I loved biology and science, but the actual lab work was not something that I was really enthusiastic about. And so, you know, I was thinking to myself, like, if I finish this degree in biology, I'm going to be working in a lab for a long time before I get to do what I find fun about science. You know, so I had this kind of little career, you know, existential crisis in college. And so the summer after my sophomore year, you know, I needed to make money. So I was looking for a job as a server. One restaurant I went into, you know, they told me they had a prep cook who didn't show up that day. And so I could have a job as a cook if I wanted to, that if I started that day. So I said, okay. Yeah. And so I started cooking just completely accidentally as a summer job, but very quickly fell in love with it. You know, working with your hands and all and everything. I really enjoyed that part. And it wasn't until after I got into cooking that I seriously got into food, you know, and enjoying food. Like I didn't, but you know, if you asked me if I was into food when I was a teenager or in college, I mean, I would have said no. Like, yeah, I like to eat. I like pizza. I like bagels, you know, but I don't go out of my way to find good restaurants or get excited about eating certain things the way I learned to after I started cooking.
It's very ironic that you didn't want to be in the lab, because of course your first book is Food Lab, your column with Grace is Food Lab, and you're known for, you know, bringing a scientific and technical take to cooking. So how did that come about? I mean, I know that at least your dad or maybe both of your parents are in the science field. Is that something that you were just always interested in?
My dad and my grandfather are scientists. And yeah, science is certainly was like the biggest part of our education growing up in a family, you know, with my grandfather and my father, who we both lived in the same building in New York. And so just the conversations they would have, and you get interested in science through osmosis, I think, growing up, at least I did. And it was always my favorite subject in school, all my sciences. And, you know, and so when I started working as a cook, you know, my natural inclination is just to approach things, you know, from a science perspective, wanting to know how things work, wanting to know why things work, wanting proof about why things work a certain way and why, you know, why one way is better than another, which is sort of like antithetical to how kitchens tend to operate. You know, restaurant kitchens, like they're about sort of precision and consistency, and you don't really have the time to explore things and run experiments or do things like that. You know, the types of things that I wanted to do.
So Kenji left restaurant kitchens and got a job in the test kitchen at Cook's Illustrated Magazine and America's Test Kitchen. And with the exception of co-owning a restaurant in the Bay Area, he's been in food media ever since. So you do a lot of testing. For example, one of the things was, you know, trying to find the best way to peel eggs. You like went through a lot of eggs to figure out the best way. Could you give an example of maybe one of the more intense tests that you did that took a really long time, and how many times you did it over and over again?
Well, I mean, that egg one, the boiled egg one project I'd been working on for like 7 or 8 years.
Oh.
So when I was a cook, I used to work a breakfast shift, and part of my job was boiling and peeling eggs.
It's like wallpaper, you know, if you get a good one, it's so satisfying, but if it
doesn't
come off.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and it peels
off
nice and cleanly.
That's why I say, like, that's why they call them deviled eggs. It's the devil's work.
And, you know, at the type of restaurant I was working at, it's like if the egg had any kind of, like, crack or divot or anything dimple in it when you peeled, like if you cracked the white when you peeled it, you couldn't serve it. And so we'd have egg salad sandwiches for lunch a lot. But you know, so a good like 30% of the eggs maybe would end up with surfaces that were not perfect. And so that was one of the questions I always had, like, why do some of the eggs stick and why do some of them peel cleanly? And so when I was working at Serious Eats, that was one of my very first experiments that I did, where, I cooked eggs a bunch of different ways. I thought of all the variables I could think of, like the age of the egg, the pH of the water, how long they were boiled for, whether you shocked them in ice water afterwards, whether you started them in cold water or hot water, all these different variables. And so I cooked eggs a bunch of different ways. And then I had like about a half dozen people come in and peel them, not knowing how I had cooked the eggs beforehand. And we measured how long it took people to peel the eggs. I got like a descriptive measure of how difficult they felt it was to peel a given egg. We then counted like all the scars and divots and cracks in the eggs and stuff like that. And then a few years later, for the New York Times, this is just a couple years ago now, I repeated that test, this time with more variables and way more testers. So I got around 100 people, volunteers, wow, to come into my restaurant and peel eggs, which they did. And so I spent a whole day getting data from people just sitting around and peeling eggs. You know, what we eventually figured out was that the only thing that like by far matters the most is the temperature of the water before you put the eggs in. So if the water is boiling and you lower the eggs into boiling water, they will peel generally quite easily. Or if you put them to like a preheated steamer, they'll peel quite easily. If you start them in cold water and slowly bring them up to temperature, then the egg whites end up fusing to the shell. And so like what I had always heard was like use older eggs for peeling because they peel better. Didn't seem to make any difference at all. And I tested it with like eggs that were 60 days old versus eggs that I literally pulled out of
popped
the chicken. I didn't pull them out of the chicken, but I pulled out of the hen house that morning. And it didn't really make any difference at all.
Wow. I also feel so smug because that's how I make my eggs. And I have been noticing since I started that method that they peel really easily. For that experiment or both of them, how many eggs do you think you went through to come to this very simple conclusion?
All the tests I've done over the years, like probably between like 1500 and 2000 eggs, I would say.
That's a lot of eggs. How does it work in general? You know, like you were with Serious Eats for a long time. You write for New York Times. Do they fund these kind of things or is this just something you put your own money into?
No, it's generally funded. You know, that was one of the perks of working at Serious Eats. Well, you know, doing recipe development in general is that when I started working at Serious Eats, like my wife was a grad student. I was like a freelance writer. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but I knew that like at least our food, we might have to eat boiled eggs, you know, every day for a week, but at least we had food.
Yeah. So sticking with the egg theme for a moment, the New York Times always releases, you know, the most clicked on recipes in the food section for the year. And so this came out for 2021. I was so shocked to see that your recipe for scrambled eggs was the most popular recipe of the year. What do you think that says about American culture, the way that people cook, what people want from cooking, that was the most popular?
Well, so I don't think it's necessarily because everybody wants a scrambled egg recipe. You know, I think the reason eggs are always a popular subject to write about is because they're the food that like the vast majority of people, I think, learn to sort of cook first, right? The first thing I learned how to cook was a fried egg, right? Or scrambled eggs. And it's something that, you know, a lot of people will do a couple times a week, you know, cook eggs. And so it's this thing that people have very long-lasting and intense experiences with, and then also have a lot of opinions on, right? Because you eat it so often, like you develop opinions on it. So even more than like an opinion on pizza or an opinion on, you know, bagels, whatever, like people have really strong opinions on eggs. And so if somebody comes and says, hey, like I tested all this stuff with eggs, like here's a cool new way to cook them.
They feel challenged.
They feel challenged. Yeah. And if you look at the comments on that article,
like, oh my God.
Yeah. People are very opinionated about eggs. So I think, you know, half the people clicking on the article were there because they were interested in learning a new way to cook eggs. And the other half were there because they wanted to jump straight to the comments and explain how they cook their eggs, you know?
Totally. They wanted to mansplain you eggs. If there is anything you take away from this episode, drop your eggs into already boiling water and watch those eggshells peel away like your worries when you take a bath in Calgon. Don't know what I'm talking about? You're probably under 35 years old. Personally, I am a big fan of the 8-minute egg. When I boil an egg straight out of the fridge for 8 minutes, it comes out perfectly jammy, gooey, not too liquidy, definitely not cooked hard. And with that, it is exactly time for a break. When we come back, Kenji reveals his last meal, and a food scientist answers this question. Can you learn to like spicy foods, or is a tolerance for spice genetic? If you're a fan of naturally gorgeous, off-the-beaten-path vacation spots with small-town charm, you're going to want to plan a visit to Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, where you can grab a scoop of homemade ice cream and stroll around the adorable European seaside village of Paulsbo, or walk on the ferry in Seattle and get off in downtown Bainbridge Island. And May is the perfect month to visit Bremerton or Silverdale, where you can get out of the city and into the forest in just 15 minutes for a beautiful hike. Enjoy a farm-to-table meal at Bremerton's Restaurant Lola, a Black-owned business. I really need to make the trip out there for their Creole brunch. And in the morning, stop by Saboteur Bakery for croissants that are so flaky and buttery, you'll think you're in Paris. There's also a gorgeous golf course in the middle of the forest, and there are several naval museums in Bremerton. Go to visitkitsap.com/yourlastmeal to learn more. That's K-I-T-S-A-P. Or you can find a link in the show notes. Play and stay on the Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. If you like listening to Your Last Meal, you might like watching my new TV show, The Nosh with Rachel Bell. We just wrapped up season one, so there are 4 tasty episodes ready for you to binge at cascadepbs.org. In episode one, I convince an East Coast skeptic that Seattle now has fantastic bagels. And in the season finale, we go truffle hunting just about an hour outside of Seattle. Episodes are a quick bite. Just 8.5 minutes long. So grab a snack and cozy up with The Nosh. Available anytime, anywhere at cascadepbs.org or find a link in the show notes. What would your last meal be?
Mapo tofu. So my mom is Japanese, and we grew up eating Japanese style mapo tofu, which is, you know, based on the Sichuan original, but quite different. So my mom would make it with ground beef. We lived in New York in Morningside Heights, which was like a sort of meatpacking area at the time. And my mom would just buy like black market beef. Like there'd be people who worked at the butcher shops who, when your car was like at a red light, they would come to your window with a cooler and be like, do you want steaks? Do you want hamburger? And you'd pay like a dollar a pound for the steaks, and they just hand it to you through the window. It was always some kind of mystery meat. But we would get ground beef, and my mother would use the same beef to make like Italian American like meat sauce. Yeah. Then she would make some of it into dumpling filling, gyoza filling, and then we would take whatever leftover gyoza filling there was, and she would turn that into mapo tofu. So it was, you know, the meat that was sautéed with garlic and ginger and scallions, and then she would use sake and soy sauce and a little bit of like chili oil, and then fold it into the soft tofu. So that was like my mother's style of mapo tofu. And then, you know, later on in my life, after I moved to Boston, which had like a very large Sichuan population. Now you can get Sichuan food virtually anywhere, but you didn't have much Sichuan food in New York at the time. You know, New York is mainly sort of Cantonese and Hong Kong style Chinese food. And especially after the ban on Sichuan peppercorns was lifted, because you couldn't get Sichuan peppercorns in the US for a while.
I didn't know that. Was that just a short period of time? Or
I think it was like sometime from like the early 90s till around 2000. You couldn't get Sichuan peppercorns in the US because they were afraid of contamination from these insects. So there was a good chunk of time when I was growing up, or like when I was in my teens, when I was learning about Sichuan food, that I never actually had Sichuan food because I never had Sichuan peppercorns, or at least certain types of Sichuan food. And so then, you know, and then I started tasting like mapo tofu the original way. And then I traveled to Chengdu and had it at like the restaurant that invented it. And both my mom's style and like the Sichuan original. Yeah, definitely be my last dish. And probably the thing I cook most frequently at home as well.
So the place that invented it in China, is it a very old restaurant or is that not a very old dish?
It's not a particularly old dish. You know, it's less than 200 years old. But so it was invented by a woman who didn't have an actual restaurant, but it was like it was a very small shop. So it then developed into a restaurant. And now there's, I think, a couple of locations. It was owned by the inventor of the dish, and they've continuously used the same recipe.
So is it just your favorite because you love it and it tastes so good? Or is there more to it? Is there any kind of sentimental value?
Well, you know, certainly there is sentimental value because it was like my favorite dish my mom made growing up. I mean, I love tofu. Tofu is like my favorite food. Pairing tofu with like doubanjiang, so like fermented chili bean paste, a lot of chili oil, and then Sichuan peppercorns. I think that, you know, that combination of mala, the hot numbing combination in Sichuan food. The first time I tried it, it blew my mind, and it still is like one of my favorite things because the first thing that happens when you eat it, it's like, well, you have the aroma of the Sichuan peppercorns, which is like the citrusy aroma and the chili aroma. And then you eat it and it tastes spicy at first, but then like your mouth gets a little bit numb and starts to tingle. One of those foods where it's like, it becomes like almost addictive to keep eating it because you want to get that feeling. Once I start eating Mapo Tofu, I feel like it's like getting a drug high where you get this like real physical sensation in your mouth from eating it that's different from most other foods that really sort of makes you want to just keep shoveling it in.
The only thing I don't like about the Sichuan peppercorn is how it makes water taste. To me, it makes it taste almost like a very watered down Sprite. And
I know that feeling.
And that's part of the addictive too, because I'll drink water and I'm like, well, now I have to eat more to cover up that taste. So it's like it's a never ending. It's such a comfort food too, because the texture of that tofu, it's just so soft, and like the sauce and everything. I mean, it's just so comforting.
It is like super comforting, the sort of custardy texture of the tofu and the warmth of it, multiple levels of heat that you get from it.
So do you like that just with rice and that would be your complete meal, or is there anything that you would
recommend? Well, you know, if I wanted to go back to my childhood, our favorite meal growing up was Mapo Tofu, steamed rice with furikake, and then gyoza on the side. So we like, you know, the first food I learned that I cooked, both me and my sisters, was gyoza. So my mom would make the filling, and then we would sit at the living room table, you know, once a month or so, we would all sit and make the dumplings and fold them. Yep. And then we'd keep them in the freezer, which is actually a thing I did with my daughter last night. So she does that now also. Every couple months, we'll make new dumplings for the freezer. And so whenever we wanted dumplings, we would have this freezer full of dumplings. And then the leftover dumpling filling she would make into the Mapo Tofu, we would cook the dumplings with it, have some rice and furikake. And that would be those three things on one plate. It's like my comfort food.
Oh, that's such a good one. For his last meal, Kenji Lopez Alt wants Mapo Tofu, either the Japanese version that his mom made growing up or the traditional Sichuan version. Rice is a non-negotiable. And if this meal echoes what he ate growing up, the rice would be sprinkled with furikake and there would be homemade gyoza on the side. If you've never had Mapo Tofu, it is delicious. It's so texturally satisfying. It's a big bowl of soft, silken tofu cubes and usually ground pork, bathed in a flavorful, fiery, brick red brothy sauce, seasoned with fermented chili bean paste, chili oil, garlic, ginger, soy, and, of course, the defining ingredient, Sichuan peppercorn, which is native to China. A spice that makes your mouth numb and tingle. A very different spice experience from chilies or wasabi. Ever since I had my first Sichuan peppercorn experience, I have been curious about what causes that tingle. So I called up Dr. Stuart Faramond, a food science specialist and author of the book Science of Spice. Okay, so we're talking about the Sichuan peppercorn. Botanically, what is this? Because with the word peppercorn attached, you know, I think a lot of people think it's related to black pepper, which it isn't.
No, the Sichuan peppercorn, it's not really a peppercorn at all because it doesn't come from the pepper tree. It's from a citrus tree. It's called the Chinese ash tree or the Chinese prickly ash tree. It belongs to the citrus family of trees. So it's nothing to do with the peppercorn. We just call it the Sichuan peppercorn because it comes from a little red berry. And when it dries, it turns into this darkened little peppercorn-like thing. And so I guess that's why we call it a peppercorn.
For people who've never had food with Sichuan peppercorn, can you describe the sensation that happens when you eat it?
It's kind of like a tingly, warm sort of flavor that you get from it. It's not really a flavor. It's more of a sensation. The Chinese call it ma la. So ma being the numbing and la being the pain. That's the sort of the sensation that you get from Szechuan peppercorn. But it's a very, very unique flavor. It's also got sort of floral notes to it and all citrusy herbal notes as well, and all this kind of eucalyptus back note there. So it's kind of quite a complex flavor. But the thing is you've got this sort of this effervescent sort of tingling sensation. It's almost like a fizzing on your tongue that you get from Szechuan.
And so what is the science behind that? Because if you have a chili pepper, you feel the burning on your tongue. If you have wasabi, you know, you get that feeling in the back of your nose. But this is totally different.
Yeah, it's quite different. Spiciness is a different sensation to taste. Taste is something that happens on our tongue, and we get sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. This is something different. So the spiciness that we get with chili is actually pain. And what happens is that chili peppers, for example, which also are completely unrelated to peppers, but we call them chili peppers, have a substance in it called capsaicin. And that's a poison. It's the same thing that you get in mace spray. It works by hijacking the pain nerves in your mouth that are sensitive to very hot temperatures. So you have special pain fibers in your mouth that only fire when temperature goes above about 50 degrees C. So if you have something really hot in your mouth and you know it burns, it's painful because these pain fibers are firing. What this capsaicin does is it hijacks them, and so you think that you're feeling this hot pain. So you feel the burning, but you're actually not having the burn of itself. So that is chili peppers. Szechuan peppercorns, they have things called sanchules in, and they give this hot, numbing, kind of tingling sort of sensation. And they do something similar. They also hijack the pain fibers, which give it that sort of that hot, numbing effect. But it also has this fizzing, almost effervescent sort of feeling. And that's because it also fires off the same nerves that are responsible for feeling inside the mouth, the tactile nerve fibers. It tickles these nerve fibers, so you get this weird sort of tingling sensation in your mouth. So that's the science of what goes on behind it.
Basically, the sanchule in Szechuan peppercorns tricks our brain into thinking something is physically touching our tongue and making it vibrate. Is there anything else that we know of beyond the Szechuan peppercorn that creates that same fizzy, tingling, numbing sensation?
I don't think there is. I've looked into this and it seems to be very unique. It seems to be Szechuan only that you can get this sensation. If somebody knows, then please let me know. But I've not yet come across anything that has the sanchules in that cause it.
Dr. Faramond says spice is what the plant uses to protect itself, to keep animals and bugs from eating it. And this is why onions make you cry. When they're still under the dirt, they use their oniony powers to keep bugs from nibbling on them.
But birds, which are immune to the heat of capsaicin, they will come along, eat them, swallow the seeds, and then when they fly off, they'll poop out the seeds somewhere else, and so the plant can spread its offspring.
So why do humans like spice? Because like you said, they're trying to defend themselves against being eaten, but we keep eating them and it does burn our mouth. Or in the case of Szechuan peppercorn, you know, it's not technically spicy. It's activating these nerves in our mouth. Why do some people like that feeling of spicy food so much?
It's strange, isn't it? We're peculiar because most animals, I won't say all animals, because I've heard of some people having pets that like spicy food. But generally speaking, in the wild, most animals don't like spicy food. It seems to be that we get a kind of a thrill out of it, much in the same way that we like watching a horror movie or we go on roller coaster rides. We get something that feels dangerous, but we know we're very safe. That seems to be what's going on. And you get this release of dopamine, which is the feel-good, rewarding brain chemical, brain hormone, which is that really rewarding thing that we get when we've done something satisfying, something fun, you know, after a roller coaster ride. It's the same thing that's released after sex, for example, all those satisfying, really rewarding things.
So, of course, there are some people who can't seem to handle any spice. Is there anything involving genetics for being able to handle spice, or can anybody train their palate to like spicy food?
Scientists have looked into that, and they've looked at sort of the genetics of people in Mexico, for example, and people in the US, and looking at, is there a genetic difference as to why people typically in Mexico can tolerate much spicy temperatures in their food than Americans can. And they can't seem to find any difference genetically that can explain it. It seems to be, it's kind of part of the culture. If you have it from when you're very young, you build up a tolerance to it. So essentially you're right. You can build up a tolerance to it over time and you get used to it. You're training your brain that this hot, painful thing isn't going to hurt you.
Kenji mentioned earlier that Szechuan peppercorn was banned in the US because of a crop bacteria. That ban lasted from 1968 to 2005. So exercise your freedom and go out to a Szechuan restaurant and order a big hot bowl of Mapo tofu. And this is my big tip. If they have a cold cucumber dish on the menu, which they often do, order that too. It will be your savior. Trust me. When we come back, we will discuss the Kenji effect, a term invented by Seattle restaurants. And Kenji has the least picky child in the world. He will tell us what she wants for her birthday dinner. And I'm willing to bet that 90% of you, maybe 95% of you, would not eat this food. We'll be right back. Kenji moved from the Bay Area to Seattle during the pandemic, and my city's food lovers are still completely a-Twitter. The Seattle Times wrote an article about the Kenji effect. Every time Kenji posts on Instagram about a restaurant that he ate at, that business gets mobbed with customers. The article says, quote, "Recipients of a Lopez Alt food shout-out sometimes have their fortunes changed within hours. Bistros with a trickle of business suddenly find lines 2 blocks long. Delis reportedly sell out of what he orders and have to change their production schedule to suit the new demand." Do you feel any kind of responsibility for the way that you write about food when it involves a local restaurant?
Increasingly, yes. You know, there was a time in my life when I didn't feel any responsibility, or it's just like, you know, when I felt like, oh, I'm just like another guy writing about stuff, you know. And then over the years, it's like, not necessarily just because my Instagram following has gotten bigger or whatever, but more just like the idea that, like, you know what, like, you know, even if I only had 10 followers, you do have a responsibility when you write things online, because you're affecting other people's opinions, right? And so, especially like when I moved to Seattle, and actually especially once the pandemic hit and, you know, the restaurant industry got hit really hard by it, the idea of like criticizing places or putting places down, or saying when you had bad experiences of places, like, I try and keep my social media feeds these days, which is basically just Instagram now, as positive as possible. Yeah. Because everyone can use positivity these days. But just on a purely practical level, it's like, if I write something positive about a restaurant, and, you know, tell people, hey, go check this out, then, you know, I help that business, but I also help readers, right? It's like people who want to find good things.
Kenji is a dad to 2 small children, including a new baby. And he does a lot of cooking with his daughter, who definitely seems to be following in his culinary footsteps.
Fish heads are always her favorite food. Like, she likes fish eyeballs in particular. For her birthday last year, we went to the fish market and got a bunch of trout heads and roasted them. She wants the same thing for her birthday this year.
Wow. But
fish heads, tofu. She loves pasta like most kids, but broccoli, frozen peas. She loves frozen peas. Mm. She'll eat most things. And, you know, and like any kids, like some days she'll not feel like eating something and she'll say, no, today I don't want to eat that. And that's fine. You know, our general approach to eating is like, you don't have to have like the USDA food plate at every meal. You don't have to have every meal doesn't have to be perfectly balanced, as long as you're getting a good variety of stuff over the course of, you know, a few days or a week, you know? And so it's like, we know, like, today, if all she wants to eat is pasta with olive oil and Parmesan, that's fine. Like, right. You know, we know that, like, she's going to eat a plate full of broccoli the next day. And, you know,
a fish head after that.
Yeah.
My dad ate the eyes when I was growing up, and I even then kind of thought it was cool. I wouldn't do it, but I remember being like, that's hardcore. I appreciate that.
She gets upset if we go to a restaurant where they serve, like, you know, like a whole trout or something like that, and it comes without the head.
Oh.
She gets really upset about it. So whenever we order fit, like, whole fish at a restaurant, we have to ask the server, like, does it come with the head? And, you know, and oftentimes they're like, no, like, they generally take it off and go, can you leave the head on?
Please.
Thanks. Yeah.
So do you eat the cheeks? Like, what is the good part of the head? Because it seems like there is a lot of bones and stuff in there.
So for me, the best part is the cheeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But my daughter, I mean, you won't even, she'll eat it down to the cartilage. Like, she'll eat the cheeks out. She'll take the tongue out. She eats the eyeballs. Like, she'll jam her finger in and get like the goopy bits out from inside. Yeah. I mean, she'll literally like rip it apart until it's just cartilage left. Anything that is soft enough to put in her mouth, she'll eat it.
You get to be smug dad. Like, everybody who's like, my kid won't eat anything. And you're like, Kenji's new book is all about wok cooking, and it's already a New York Times #1 bestseller. So I wanted to know what it is about the wok he loves so much.
It's the most versatile pan I have in my kitchen, you know, and it's the tool that I use by far the most. And as far as like the number of meals I've gotten out of it for what I spent on it, it's like orders of magnitude better than any other tool I've ever owned. You know, I bought a wok. It was $20 when I was in college. I used it to cook for friends in college. I had dinner parties when I was single. I cooked with my wife when we were, you know, living in like a tiny kitchen, tiny apartment in New York. Cook for the whole family now. So it's the same exact wok that I've used for over 20 years now. Of course, you can stir fry, which I think is the first thing people think about when cooking in a wok. And, you know, wok is better for stir frying than anything else. It's the best tool for deep frying because it contains oil spatter. It's the best tool for steaming. It's great for braising. It's great for simmering. The main ingredient is generally cooked very fast, whether it's a vegetable or fish or tofu or whatever it is. You generally cook it very fast. And then the depth of flavor comes more from adding like fermented sauces and highly seasoned aromatics and stuff like that. And so building up a pantry can be a little challenging at first, but once you start cooking in it regularly and you have that pantry going, yeah, very flavorful meals become extraordinarily quick. Sometimes I feel like cooking all day. And sometimes I just want to be able to pull stuff out of my fridge in my pantry and have dinner on the table in half an hour and have it be really tasty and easy and healthy and delicious. And I think that's where woks really excel.
And that was Kenji Lopez-Alt's last meal. Pick up his new book, The Wok, at your favorite local bookstore. So far, I've only made one thing from the book, but it was so good that I can't wait to make a couple more dishes. Over the years, I've made many variations of a sesame, soy, ginger kind of salad dressing, and it's never as good as I want it to be. But there is a salad dressing in the very back of the book with miso and sesame oil and soy and ginger and a bunch of other things that is so perfectly balanced that I can't stop dipping things into it. I'm actually having it for lunch today. Thanks to Dr. Stuart Faramond.
I was originally a medical doctor, and then I branched into doing food science. You know, I often get wheeled out on British TV programs to look at the science of pancakes, the science of gravy, whatever it is.
This episode was produced by Laura Scott and me, original theme music by Prom Queen. And if you like the theme music, which some of you have written in to say that you do, make sure and check out Prom Queen's other music that isn't theme music. She has a big bouffant and a pink rhinestone guitar. And if you like dreamy music from the 60s, you're going to dig it. Follow along on Instagram, Hello Rachel Bell, and don't want to brag, but we also have a website. It's yourlastmealpodcast.com. You can find all of the episodes there. You can send a message. You can pitch me a guest. You can let me know if you want to be a sponsor of the show. And you can learn all about Laura and me by reading our bios. Of course, if you like the show, please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal.